Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, a grand jury is taking the state of Pennsylvania to task for failing to protect the public from the health effects of fracking. We'll hear from WHYY's Susan Phillips. Also, vintage music synthesizers are becoming a hot item for collectors. Allison Stout restores old synths. She'll be along in just a bit. But to begin, back to school for Philadelphia school children should look something like this. Beginning in September, most students will attend class in brick-and-mortar buildings twice a week and will spend the rest of the time learning online. While in school buildings, children and staff will be required to wear masks or face shields and, of course, practice social distancing. There will be no temperature checks upon arrival. Self-monitoring will be the rule for staff and students and their families. And there will be increased emphasis on cleaning in the buildings. Those are just a few particulars of a recently released plan, which the district admits could change depending on how the pandemic plays out this fall. We've got Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height back with us again to talk this time about how education will likely look in the fall for Philly's 125,000 school children. And welcome back, William Height. Do we have you with us, William Height?
Yes.
Hello.
Yes. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Guessing that after months of disruption, William Height, it'll be really good to see kids and staff back in place in actual classrooms, but there have to be some mixed feelings.
Absolutely mixed feelings and a lot of anxiety as well. One of the things that we're trying to do with our Advancing Education Safely plan is to provide some face-to-face for children, albeit several days a week, and then we will have all other children on a digital platform for the other days of the week. And we have some children who will be able to come in 4 days a week, and those are children with special needs, with special complex needs, pre-K students, and students who are learning English. Everyone else will be digital for 3 days and then face-to-face for two. And in addition to that, our families will have an opportunity to select a virtual option that is to remain digital for a set period of time for the beginning of the school year. More information about that process will come out this Wednesday, July 22nd.
So, William Height, as the virus remains in the population, why does the district feel it's important to have students in traditional school settings with staff at least part of the time?
Yeah, but one of the things that we've noticed and a lot of the evidence suggested after the digital learning in the spring was that many of our young people, particularly those who are in already vulnerable categories, fall behind more during a remote learning process. And so our goal was to at least provide for some children the opportunity to come and have face-to-face instruction with an adult at least two times a week. And the reason we can't do more than two times is because of all of the distancing requirements, the sanitizing and hygiene requirements. But regardless, we think that it's really important for children to get back to seeing some adult teachers, at least a portion of the time.
So it is likely that, you know, the Philadelphia School District is a large school district, that there is some risk of COVID showing up. And if I'm reading you correctly, despite the risk, you think it's extremely important that these kids get back into the classroom so their learning can proceed.
Yeah, I think one thing that's really important is that we are not making this plan and constructing this plan in a vacuum. We are actually working with health professionals from the policy lab at the Children's Hospital. We're working with the health commissioner here in the city of Philadelphia. And while the risk of children being exposed to the virus or contracting the virus is low, we don't know yet what the opportunities are or percentages for those young people to transmit the virus. And so we have taken all of the precautions and utilizing the guidance from the health community to ensure that we're able to get children back and get them educated as safely as possible.
Many teachers are older and are at higher risk for complications from COVID. What happens if they decide they need to step back as the school year gets underway? Are there jobs at risk?
No, actually, no. So we actually did a survey with our employees earlier in the year, and naturally this was before the more recent spike in cases. And fewer had indicated that they were going to resign or retire. Most indicated that they wanted to return. And for those who are unable to return to in-person instruction, and face-to-face instruction, they will have the opportunity to work in or on the digital platform. So we can still utilize those teachers, although they will be virtual.
So that brings us to the next question. How will online instruction dovetail with in-class learning? Is staff co-teaching with an online source, or is online learning then live streamed from a classroom? Or explain how that works.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Mary Cummins. That's a really good question, and it allows me to give an example. And an example would be a child would be with a teacher in a classroom, face-to-face instruction on Monday. That child will then have some activities and tasks to do, albeit digital, on Tuesday when they are digital. They will be back again face-to-face with that teacher on Wednesday, and then they will have assignments or tasks on Thursday. And then on Friday, all children who are assigned to that teacher will then log in and have a class with that teacher, but it will be digital. So that's how that will work. And there will be multiple groups of children with the same teacher, but on different days. And then on Friday, those groups will then experience that teacher, but they will have that experience digital.
Do you feel learning will keep pace as it has in past years?
I think that it will be accelerated more than the enrichment and review that we did back in the spring. This is going to look very different, where this will feel more like a classroom. It'll feel more like directed instruction from an adult, both while children are in person and when they are digital. And even the Digital Academy, if individuals choose the all virtual model, it's highly structured. Students will have to log in every day, participate for a period of time because there will be classes, and then they will have to attend all of those classes on a daily basis. And so attendance will be taken, grades will be taken, and children will have a much more structured system throughout the day with regards to their lessons.
So new precautions, again, are being taken to clean and to monitor and try to prevent COVID infection at the buildings. This all will cost money. And in addition, the district has been grappling with asbestos issues, and I think it's at least a half a dozen buildings. Is the money there and readily available? And how much are we guesstimating or estimating?
Yeah, we're estimating on the house.
Oh, I think we lost William Height there, Philadelphia School Superintendent, and we are going to try to get him back just as soon as possible. We're talking about the start of school in the Philadelphia School District should begin early in September, a hybrid model. School children will be attending classes in brick and mortar buildings twice a week and online the rest of the time. And I understand we have Mr. Height back with us. And then as we lost you there, William Height, you were starting to address the question of how much money this is going to cost, the cleaning, and also we've got the asbestos situation too.
Yes, so we are actually addressing a lot of the asbestos. One benefit from this whole crisis is that it allowed us to close schools and get into schools earlier than we would normally do over the summer. And so we have multiple projects happening right now. We're already ahead of schedule with some of the abatement. The only thing that is holding that process up or slowing that process down is the capacity and resources to do a lot more. But we are already ahead of schedule with respect to both lead abatement and asbestos abatement. based on the fact that schools were closed. To your other question with respect to the estimate for what we could likely spend, we could likely spend an additional $60 to $80 million on making sure we have the proper PPE supplies in schools, all of the sanitizing equipment, the electrostatic sprayers, hiring more custodians and maintenance staff, and in some cases hiring more teachers. Transportation will be different because it can only take fewer children on buses. So all of those things could add up to between $60 and $80 million.
Is the money there?
It is there. No, it is not there, Mary Cummins, and that's one of the reasons we are advocating for the passage of the HEROES Act or something very similar that will then get money to districts like ours in order to offset some of those expenses.
We've got a question from a caller. Why isn't the district requiring temperature checks upon entry?
That's a great question, and thanks to the caller for that question. One of the things that we have learned from the Children's Hospital and from the health professionals. And when this first started, there was a lot of talk about temperature checks and all of those things. But now the recommendation has been against temperature checks because the temperature checks have not been able to diagnose positive cases. And so it is... the recommendation of all the healthcare professionals that we utilize that time and energy on either pre-screening or making sure individuals have an opportunity to see a child to see if, in fact, they are flushed or they may not be feeling well, and then we would take the necessary precautions. Temperature checks have, to my knowledge, and this is from the health community, have not identified one positive case of COVID-19.
And one more quick question as we're up against the clock here. Just a follow-up to an earlier comment. If that $60 to $80 million does not materialize by the start of the school year, what does that mean for the plan to reopen?
We will still do all of those things that I just described, and hopefully it's going to be at the lower side, but it will impact next year's budget. So next year we may have to the following year's budget, we will have to likely begin cuts to resources or programs unless we receive those additional dollars either from the state, the city, or the federal government.
And the first day back, September 2nd, not quite set in stone?
Not quite set in stone. It's more set than it was before, but all of these things are subject to change, Mary Cummins, simply because this is a very fluid situation.
All right, William Height, superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia. As always, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
All right, take care. We'll be talking to WHYY's Susan Phillips up next about a grand jury report and the latest efforts to reform fracking in Pennsylvania. Stay tuned. You're listening.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
To the regional roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the next few minutes, we'll be getting the latest on fracking and its effect on Pennsylvanians who live near natural gas drilling sites. A state grand jury heard testimony from numerous residents who complained of contaminated water, nausea, headaches, nosebleeds, dead livestock. But according to the grand jury report released in late June, there was little relief from state government, especially in the early days of the industry. In fact, the grand jury was scathing in its criticism of the Department of Environmental Protection, concluding that the DEP's responses amounted to a message, leave fracking alone. The Department of Health was also taken to task. As State Attorney General Josh Shapiro put it, it's the governor's government's job to set and enforce the ground rules that protect the public interest. Through multiple administrations, they failed. So now that the grand jury report has been released, what happens next? WHYY's Susan Phillips has been reporting on this story for many years, and she joins us now to help us parse this complex story. Susan Phillips, hello.
Hi, Mary.
It's been a while since we've addressed fracking on the Roundup. So to begin, remind us briefly of how hydraulic fracturing works and the risks to the environment if protective measures are not taken.
Yeah, so fracking is basically a method of harvesting gas from a deep rock formation like shale. And in this case, of course, it's Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale. It's different than previous methods that were used because the drill goes deeper and then turns horizontally to access this really tight rock. They put explosives down the hole that are used to fracture the rock, and then after that, there's high-pressure water and chemicals that help release the gas from, again, a very hard, tight rock. It's not like a pool of gas that sits down there like you would think of in conventional wells. And so while the industry term technically refers to a specific part of the drilling process, fracking really has come to mean the entire production process to lay people. And one of the major risks in the early part of the gas boom in Pennsylvania was bad well construction, which led to shale gas and other chemicals that were used in the fracking process. It led to them leaking into an aquifer and contaminating drinking water for people in rural Pennsylvania who rely on drinking water wells. And that's, for example, what happened in Dimmock.
As you report for State Impact Pennsylvania, investigators for the grand jury spoke with at least 75 families about their experiences. Susan, what were some of the more impactful stories members of the grand jury heard?
Yeah, you know, when I was reading that, what was really interesting is it mimicked everything I heard from people when I started reporting this 10 years ago, right? So their water started turning brown or black. There was a chemical smell, inexplicable skin lesions after showering, sick towels, nosebleeds, headaches. But one story that stands out from the report is of a man who saw a stream on his property started turning different colors as they were drilling nearby. He took a video and called the Department of Environmental Protection, which then turned around and told him, instead of investigating it, they basically told him he could be fined for filing a false report. And that's the one thing you hear over and over again in this report, and what I heard from people back then was that, you know, they thought the state was supposed to help them, but they kept running into brick walls at either the Department of Environmental Protection or the Department of Health. So, yeah, it echoes a lot of the stories I heard and reported on 10 years ago.
And the grand jury found that the department was simply unprepared or unwilling to regulate the industry, especially in the early years of the gas rush?
Yeah. You know, and I think I found that, too. They were definitely unprepared. You know, the unwilling part is where you start to get tricky. I'm sure there were some employees who were willing, but, you know, you got to remember that even, you know, starting in the Rendell administration, cuts to DEP have been pretty drastic, and there's just not enough people to go out and investigate some of these claims, investigate them well.
Essentially, though, there was a concern that political pressure might have been brought to bear at DEP.
Yeah, that's the implication. And certainly the gas industry wields a lot of power and influence in Harrisburg to this day. But, you know, and you got to remember also that Governor, when Rendell was in office, he was the one that sort of ushered in the gas industry. He was very supportive. And then after that, there was the Republican Governor Tom Corbett. He was even more supportive of the gas industry. And, you know, under Corbett as well, is what happened was there was a lot of pushback and there were reforms in terms of regulations under Corbett. But I think when Wolf came into office, a lot of people thought he would do a much better job at regulating the industry, and I think a lot of people were disappointed at that.
What did the grand jury find? Was Governor Wolf's administration taken to task?
You know, that's what's interesting. Not directly. So DEP was taken to task, and DEP lawyers, in responding to the report, basically pushed back pretty hard and said they were unsubstantiated. claims and unreliable claims, because these people were talking about things that happened 5-10 years ago. You know, Josh Shapiro, the attorney general, is a Democrat. Wolf is a Democrat, so he didn't really call out Wolf directly. It's also, you know, speculated that, you know, Shapiro wants to run for governor, so that's the other reason why he came out with this report at the time he did, according to, you know, a lot of people. But I think, I mean, one of the things that happened early in the Wolf administration was Range Resources, who has since been charged criminally by a grand jury over their handling of issues out in Washington County. Early on in the Wolf administration, under DEP Secretary John Quigley, who came in and really wanted to hold the industry accountable, they were fined. The company was fined. And Wolf Quigley was basically fired by Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And after that happened, that fine against Range Resources disappeared. And that's something that a lot of people point to when they say, well, you know, Wolf wasn't what we thought he was going to be when it came to the oil and gas industry. Although, you know, it's not as if the DEP under Wolf hasn't done things to hold them accountable either. There's been some heavy fines. There's been actually more inspections under the Wolf administration.
And yet, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, he's a Democrat, as is, of course, Governor Wolf, seemed to be taken aback by the response of the DEP, the Wolf administration DEP, to this grand jury report, especially, where the DEP attorney's response to the report, I'm reading some notes here, claimed the health impacts of fracking were not significant. He responded, you know, Shapiro did, that's the words not of fracking companies, but from the DEP, the people that are supposed to be working for you. Respectfully, said Shapiro, that attitude is part of the problem we are facing in Pennsylvania. So he kind of taps Wolf with a feather duster, it seems here.
Yeah, he goes after the DEP. But, you know, the DEP, you know, ultimately the head of the DEP, Patrick McDonnell, he answers to Wolf. So although he went after DEP in the report, he didn't actually go after DEP's boss, which is interesting.
Well, let's get to some of the recommendations in this report. I mean, the big question is, we've got these recommendations from the grand jury. Okay, what next now? For instance, one of the recommendations says wells have to be set back 500 feet from buildings. Right now, wells have
That's
to be set back.
Yeah,
right, 500 feet from buildings. What would the grand jury like to see here? And do we see this happening?
So, yeah, they want to increase that setback to 2,500 feet. Do we see this happening? Probably not. It would take, you know, the legislature to enact, you know, a rule about that. And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. You know, we still have a Republican legislature in Harrisburg. And again, they're very supportive of the gas industry by and large. And, you know, even to be fair, even some Democrats are supportive as well. The Democrats from southwestern Pennsylvania have traditionally been supportive of the gas industry.
Sure. And there were other recommendations, which include, you know, make public the chemicals used in the fracking process, make the transportation of toxic waste safer, strengthen air pollution regulations of fracking-related sites, assess public health in relation to fracking. So, again, these recommendations have to get through the GOP-led legislature, which has been very friendly to the fracking industry. So if I'm hearing you correctly, Susan, it doesn't seem as if they're going to go anywhere anytime soon.
No, except for the public health recommendations, which the Department of Public Health has said they would enact, and they would start looking at public health implications of fracking more closely. But I know that recently there were some public health workers in southwestern Pennsylvania who are active around these issues, and they reported recently that they were disappointed in their meetings with the Department of Public Health. So we'll see what happens with that. But that is something that the Department of Public Health can do without any kind of legislation.
Okay. We've been talking about the current legislature, which, of course, is Republican-led. What was the response overall from GOP lawmakers to the grand jury report?
They rejected it. You know, I mean, they pushed back. They said it was political. So, yeah, they chalked it up to politics, basically.
And what are environmentalists saying, Susan Phillips?
Well, most environmentalists cheered it, but a lot of people were sort of grumbling in the background, maybe not publicly, but saying they wished that Shapiro would hold the Wolf administration accountable for a lot of the things that have happened over the last 5 or 6 years.
Tell us about the industry response to accusations of environmental harm in Pennsylvania over the years.
Yeah, I mean, it's predictable what they, I mean, they basically put out statements saying that they care about the environment. And, you know, I mean, to be honest, it's not a monolith. There are different companies out there. Some are better than others. So, yeah, they basically push back on it.
As you mentioned earlier, there were criminal presentments against two drilling companies, Range Resources and Cabot Oil and Gas. You also report, Susan, that it's more common to charge a company than an individual in this sort of situation. Why is that?
Well, so I've talked to a number of environmental attorneys about this, and it's really just hard to file criminal charges against people who aren't doing their jobs very well, right? It's not a criminal act to not do your job very well. You know, I think if there were actual bribery, you know, an envelope of cash going from one hand to the other, that's one thing, but nobody has accused anybody of that. So for the most part, at least up until now, the criminal charges have been filed against two companies, Range Resources and Cabot Oil and Gas. And but at the same time, the Attorney General says there will be more to come of these investigations. So we'll see.
So it seems as if it's kind of the status quo for homeowners who happen to be living near drilling sites. Things have gotten a little bit better, but if there are some issues, I guess the question is, to whom can they turn if they have issues with fracking?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry. Cut out.
Sure. So as far as relief for homeowners who might be experiencing issues with fracking, to whom can they turn? Can they reliably now go to the DEP and the Department of Health to find relief? Or is there another entity that might better help them in the state of Pennsylvania?
Well, at this point, when Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced the fracking report, he did, you know, establish a phone number, a hotline, which is something that activists have been asking for years, right? And so now there is a phone number that people can call and potentially get help, or they could email. I think the email is just simply fracking@attorneygeneral.gov. So that, you know, is another avenue if people find that they're, you know, not getting a response from DEP or the Department of Health.
Governor Wolf, Susan Phillips, has been trying for years unsuccessfully to get a severance tax on natural gas extraction enacted in Pennsylvania. That said, is it fair to say he is supportive of natural gas as part of the state's overall energy plan?
He definitely is. And, you know, that's an interesting conundrum for him. On the one hand, you know, he's pushing, he's definitely pushed for an extraction tax. He feels like the industry has the money to pay, you know, a larger share to help a revenue in Pennsylvania. But he's failed at each and every turn because the Republicans are against it. But he also, you know, he's also got this climate plan, right? I mean, there's a lot of contradictions to his environmental policy. But at the same time, he's a Democrat and the environmentalists, I suppose, felt he was better than a Republican governor, so he's in there for a second term.
Wolf is also backing legislation to give tax credits of tens of millions of dollars to petrochemical plants, which would turn natural gas into industrial chemicals and fertilizers. You know, again, he generally backs environmental causes, so some might find this at odds, you know, support of the petrochemical industry. Is that what you're hearing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of disappointment from people on the left and environmentalists about his support of that industry. But again, it's an interesting line that he walks because, like you said, he supports gas, he supports the petrochemical industry. I mean, he'll tell you that they're good jobs, and they are. But at the same time, he is also working on issues around climate change. So it's seemingly a contradiction if you're on the one hand working to stop climate change and then on the other hand working to promote fossil fuel development.
Okay, well, the fracking story continues in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure we'll hear some of your reporting on that in the near future, Susan. We've got about a minute left, and I'm going to switch gears here for just a moment because I know you've also been covering another story for WHYY, and that is the homeless encampments on the Ben Franklin Parkway and in front of PHA headquarters. They were supposed to have been broken up last Friday. That has not happened, and the understanding is that there might be negotiations between city officials and the organizers of these encampments this week. Is that what you're hearing?
That's right. I mean, Mayor Kenney announced that last Friday that he was willing to sit down with the activists and the folks who are experiencing homelessness right now and talk to them and try to come to some mutually, agreeable decision about what to do with that homeless camp. Homeless encampment, on the parkway. And then, again, like you said, there's also one outside of PHA headquarters in North Philadelphia. So that's been a real bone of contention with the city, and the two have sort of been at an impasse at this point. But it looks like Mayor Kenney, feels like he can get in there and make something happen and get a resolution. So that's We'll see what happens with that as well.
Yeah, I've got about 20 seconds left. I was a little surprised to hear that Mayor Kenney was going to go and directly become involved in the negotiations. As an observer, were you surprised as well or not?
I wasn't really surprised, to be honest. I mean, it is something that, the folks at the encampment said they wouldn't leave, even though they were given an eviction order. So it sort of was incumbent upon the mayor to step in at that point.
All right, Susan Phillips, reports for State Impact Pennsylvania, WHYY. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, we'll talk soon. Coming up, Allison Stout is owner and technician of Bell Tone Synthworks. She repairs vintage synthesizers from all over the country. We'll hear her story in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Those of us who came of age in the late 70s and 80s will surely recognize the synthesizer riff from Gary Numan's Cars. Music synthesizers have been around since the late 1950s, often featuring a keyboard. The synthesizer is defined as a machine which electronically generates and modifies sound. There's more to it than that, of course. The synthesizer sound helped change the concept of modern music, becoming an integral part of much of what we've heard in performance over the last six decades. There's a lot of nostalgia associated with that sound. And perhaps this is why synthesizers built during the latter half of the 20th century are eagerly sought by musicians and collectors alike, meaning there's a market for those who do the restoration work. Allison Stout is one of the few women in the business. She is owner of Bell Tone Synthworks in West Philadelphia. And welcome to the Regional Roundup, Allison.
Hi.
Hello. So what is it about the synthesizer sound that draws us in as listeners, maybe as much, if not more at times, than traditional instruments?
I guess the synthesizer sound isn't just one sound. It's a type of instrument that can be used to make a near infinite number of sounds. I guess what most people tend to think of as like classic synthesizer sounds, or the things that you hear and you think that's a synthesizer, are synthesizers from the 70s and 80s, and they're most familiar to us. But I guess they really just are heavily associated with certain types of music. So you start thinking about, like the 80s and the culture of that time, or the 70s. And it's sort of like, I think it is a nostalgia thing for a lot of people, like cultural nostalgia. And then now, there's just synthesizers in all popular music. But I don't think people think about quite as much in the same way.
Yeah, but they're just appealing, and there's something about them that when you hear some of these riffs, you just can't get them out of your head.
Yeah.
So let's focus for just a moment on the synths of the 70s and 80s. What were some of the bigger names and what were some of their unique characteristics?
Well, I guess the 70s was mostly dominated by American synth companies. And the big brand was Moog. They made the first keyboard synthesizer that was affordable to average musicians, which was the Mini Moog Model D, which is still one of the most famous and popular synthesizers. Before that, most synthesizers were only available to universities or professional recording studios, and they were huge systems and very expensive. But the Mini Moog, though it was still pretty expensive, was the first one that people could actually buy and own and play on stage.
And that was a Mini Moog that was used in cars, right?
I think, well, cars actually is a lot of, Gary Numan used a lot of different synths on that album, but I think a lot of it more is Poly Moog, but
Well, listen, you have a number of synthesizers at your shop in West Philadelphia, and you've also you've recorded some demonstrations, and I'd like to get to one of your demonstrations of something called the EMS Synthy synthesizer, made back in 1969. So let's take a listen. It almost sounds like something that could be, made for a sci-fi movie or something.
Yes.
So tell us about that one.
So this was actually perhaps, I think, the very first synthesizer that was ever compact and affordable and marketed towards musicians, even before the Mini Moog. And it was made by a British company called EMS. It's a very idiosyncratic synthesizer, even to this day. It's fully modular, which means that the circuits that have different functions aren't connected to each other so that the signal passes through it automatically. You actually have to construct the signal chain yourself by patching signals together using this pin matrix. And its behavior is just very kind of wild and chaotic because of the patching system. And it's pretty hard to play conventional melodic music on it, but it's really extraordinarily good for making wild sound effects.
There's a long-running...
Like the ones that we recorded for that clip.
I'm sorry for jumping in on you. There's a debate, and it's been around forever, or at least since digital's been with us, about which is better, analog or digital. Where do you land?
Well, I actually think that each has its own advantages. There are methods of synthesis that exist only in digital, which are really, really interesting, like FM synthesis. And I think a lot of the sort of like reputation that digital synthesis has for sounding cheesy is just based on the presets, like the factory presets that the synths were shipped with, and the fact that they were just like overused in pop music, and people think, oh, those are ridiculous, terrible, cheesy sounds. But the truth is that with almost any kind of synthesis, you can make really beautiful, interesting sounds. But today, digital synthesis can also be used to create an emulation of an analog synth, which is indistinguishable from the real thing, from a real analog synth. And I think a lot of purists don't want to believe that, but I should be, like, as largely an analog synth technician, it may seem like I should be an analog purist myself, but I'm also, I guess, a pragmatist. And I understand that the digital technology has gotten to the point that just like the resolution is so good that you can actually create a very, very convincing analog sound.
So it's all good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can even the synthesizer that seems the stupidest and the worst sounding synthesizer if you spend some time with it, you can make a really cool sound. It's really like all up to the player.
You told our producer, John Ahrens, that you've been studying music since high school and assumed you were going to get a degree in orchestration. How did you get from there to your current work restoring synthesizers?
I emerged from college with a bachelor's degree in music composition, and I was a classically trained pianist and flutist also, but I was playing keyboards in a psychedelic pop band, and I just started feeling like I want some weird noises. So I was actually just playing like a Rhodes electric piano at that time, but instead of going and like buying a synthesizer the way a normal person might, I just started looking online for circuits and started building synthesizers. So I actually built a synthesizer before I ever bought one. And then when I started doing that, I realized I was just really, really, really fascinated by electronics theory. So I suddenly kind of pivoted and put all this energy into studying electronics. Started doing like a vocational school program for electronics technician certification. And at the same time, I was building synths for myself to just make weird noises on, and finally bought my own first like commercial synthesizer, and then started on the side just doing simple repairs and then buying broken instruments and repairing them to sell. And that was that all started about 10 years ago.
And today,
I just continued doing that for many, many years, like on the side. And then 4 years ago, I switched over to doing it full time.
So there aren't many women who do what you do. And my understanding is, you know, sometimes clients are surprised to see you at the shop. What is the reaction? I mean, it's not always pleasant. Any favorite, in quotation marks, gender-related lines that you get?
Well, the one thing that is very common is when I answer the phone, I'll get a guy being like, "Hey, hun, can you connect me to the person who fixes the instruments?"
Oh, gosh.
And I try to make it as awkward for them as possible. I'll just be like, "Yes," and then pause. That's me. I can't be like too, I don't want to be like alienatingly
sure.
hostile or anything, but I do want to make them like think about, you know, why they made the assumption that they did. And for the most part, I mean, it is kind of funny, but it also gets really old. And the other thing that I face is people just basically mansplaining things to me, which is baffling because it's, like they've already accepted that I know what I'm doing and decided to bring their instrument to me for repair, but they still have this cognitive dissonance that makes them think that there's no way I actually know what I'm doing, and they just can't help explaining things to me, usually incorrectly. Yeah, it's very strange.
Well, do you see, has being a woman made it difficult to become established in the tech world, and do you see this changing?
For the most part, I think it's actually been okay. I think that sometimes people may be a little surprised or skeptical at first. But I think my work and the work of the rest of my team speaks for itself. And we get a lot of our business through word of mouth. So we'll have, you know, someone's friend will already be vouching for us. And I also have a blog where I documented repairs for several years, which I deliberately did to sort of prove to the world that I knew what I was doing. And I think that helps a lot as well.
Let's take a listen from another one of your demonstrations. This is a Sequential Circuits Prophet 5 from 1978. That sounds like it could have come from the band Boston or something like that.
That was actually the Arp Odyssey.
Yeah. Well, so tell us about that. Is this one of those synthesizers that is being sought after by collectors and musicians at this point? And have you seen them come into your office, a number of them?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I was just clarifying that that clip was the Arp Odyssey.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Not the Prophet 5. But, oh, yeah, the Arp Odyssey is actually one of the ones we work on the most. They're still really, really popular. And even though they were actually so popular that they've been reissued by two companies within the past few years, so you can actually buy a brand new replica of an Arp Odyssey, but the vintage ones are still really popular. And so they came out in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, starting around 1975, and they were sort of a competitor to the Mini Moog by another American company. And similarly, were a sort of compact, relatively affordable keyboard synthesizer, like aimed at live performing musicians. And they were really popular with rock bands. And they're duophonic, which means you can play two notes at once. And they have, they have like a characteristic, very bright, kind of zappy sound, which is kind of different from the thicker Moog sound. But yeah, we work on those all the time. They're probably the second most common synth that we work on, and they're fun. There's three different versions with different filters, so there are a few different like kind of permutations with slightly different sounds, but they're cool.
Well,
yeah.
when you say fun, what's fun about opening up a synthesizer? And I mean, do you have some detective work that you have to do to figure out some of these old instruments, if you will, these old machines? What's fun?
I'm not sure everyone would think it was fun. like a lot of it is just looking at schematics, and basically the first thing, if you get to the point where you look at a schematic and you can actually understand how the circuit's supposed to work, and you have to compare that to what it's actually doing if it's not working correctly. And basically it's a combination of understanding of electronic theory and then just deductive reasoning and sort of using the scientific method, which means finding out ways to eliminate variables so that you can zero in on the cause of the issue. But then there's also all these weird wild cards just from things being old.
So, quickly, you know, we only have about a minute. What's a weird wild card that you uncovered in your restoration of a vintage synthesizer?
Well, this wasn't a synthesizer. It was an organ. We also work on organs. But we did find a dead mouse stuck to the circuit board, and its bodily fluids had all leaked out and corroded the circuit traces.
Okay.
So, well, that's kind of the absolute worst case scenario.
I was going to ask you about the restoration that gave you the most joy. That would not be it, I guess.
No, that was the low point, I would say.
Well, what is there one particular synthesizer that you remember above all others that you've worked on over the years?
One of my favorites, or perhaps my favorite, is the Sequential Circuits Prophet 10, which is like the Prophet 5, but two of them, basically two keyboards and 10 voices. And it's just I love the Prophet 5. It's a fantastic sounding synthesizer. The Prophet 5 was actually the first polyphonic synth that used digital voice allocation. So it was a huge advancement in synth technology. But a couple of years later, they produced the Prophet 10, which is basically two of the same things in a big case. And it's just an enormously powerful synthesizer, and it sounds really beautiful, and you can do so much with it. But we restored two recently, and one of them also was just the most like nightmarishly destroyed thing.
Well, listen,
restored.
I wish we had more time. We have to stop you there because we're out of time, but it sounds like a fascinating business to be in, and what fun. Thank you so much for joining us, Allison.
All right. Thank you.
Allison Stout is owner of Belltone Synthworks in West Philadelphia. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens is producer for the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.